Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Traditional physical therapy after suffering from a stroke or spinal cord injury can become boring after a while. That's why Lise Worthen Chowdhury, a dancer turned researcher, invented an interactive therapy to make it fun by combining physical rehabilitation with the arts. Lise Worthen Chowdhury is a physical medicine and rehabilitation professor and the associate director of the Motion Analysis and Recovery Laboratory at Ohio State University. She joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Before we went on the air, you were telling me you're the first non-clinician, non-PhD, that to be in this kind of a job at the OSU Medical Center. And that just tells me that they're really recognizing that the importance of the arts in this way.
Absolutely. I can't stress enough how willing they were to take a leap of faith and to blend science and art in order to advanced physical rehabilitation.
What got you interested in science and art and medicine and rehabilitation?
Oh, that's a good question. I started out as a dancer. And I actually danced professionally in San Francisco. Honestly, dancers don't make a lot of money.
Right. So because
it's kind of people I know. Right. The economics of it.
Right.
So you have a second job. And I sort of was like, well, I could work at Starbucks, but could I do a second job that actually was as meaningful to me? And I love movement. Small, funny story. So I went to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and my undergrad degree is a BFA in dance. And we were in the basement of this building, Topman Gym. And if you were to walk, kind of like make a right instead of a left in Topman Gym, instead of getting to the basement part that's the dance program, you would get to the basement part that was the biomechanics program. And I literally was just exploring. And I turned to the right and I said, wow, what is this? Oh my gosh, those cameras, are they actually recording motion? Could I do a graduate degree in this? And that was it.
Wow. You designed, the reason why you're here, I could talk to you all hour about this alone, but you designed a software program that allows patients to create artwork while doing their physical therapy. Now, your background is in dance. So when we talk to you, you're, on the other hand, you embrace all the arts as potential candidates for physical therapy.
Absolutely. And in interactive art, I pull from visual art. My aesthetic is to create music output or visual art output that encourages people to move in different ways. So because of that, we call it dance interactive art, because the point is motion. But the output is any form of art. It could be storytelling.
And it takes their mind off what they're actually doing.
Yep.
It's kind of that spoonful of sugar.
Yep. Spoonful of sugar. And if you think about, 50 years ago, we used to think that there was no ability for the neural system to change after, say, a stroke or spinal cord injury. Mm-hmm. And now we know it's completely the opposite, that there's all sorts of room for remodeling, and they call it neuroplasticity. But neuroplasticity is actually experience dependent. So what you experience on the outside, how your body moves and how your body experiences is what's driving the neural change. So that's the arts. So it sort of is a logical jump. I think we're so new with this whole neural remodeling thing. Nobody had really thought about it in those terms before.
And what has it been like? Tell me about what the research tells us, the evidence-based part of this. What have we learned from the research?
So in addition to being a dancer, I'm a biomechanist. And so I have a motion capture lab and force platforms that record the forces that people kind of emit on the world or that the world experiences from the person.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Newton's forces while they're moving. So based on that, we take the actual sensor data. So that abstract art image that's being created is actually digital documentation of how much movement has occurred. Taking that, we have found, starting from the beginning, we found that patients would actually sort of go into this flow state where they would lose track of time. I mean, we've had patients who previously in DOD, inpatient rehabilitation, therapists were like, wow, they're not motivated. They're depressed. They don't want to move. And they start moving. And the minute that they get to interact with this artwork and create something on their own, on their terms, you can't stop
them.
They don't stop moving. Yeah. Yeah. People are smiling. I mean, you know, not to make light of what they've gone through. You know, what they've gone through is life-changing, whether it's a spinal cord injury, a stroke, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Traumatic brain injury. But they still have joy. They still, you know, can we still find those moments?
And then, again, making this whole therapeutic process easier on the brain, mm-hmm. instead of getting bored and mm-hmm. leaving the tediousness of it. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about arts in physical therapy. My guest is Lise Worthen-Chowdhury. She's an associate director of the Human Motion Analysis and Recovery Laboratory, and she's also a dancer, and she's combined the two ideas of therapy and the arts to change the experience for people with serious injuries. Describe exactly what we're doing. I've looked at some of the things that the pictures that people have made in the process of therapy, and there's really cool things. And you're studying everything from the impact of color to texture to, I mean, there's all different aspects of this. But so if I'm in Dodd and I'm recovering from a stroke and my right arm is the thing that needs the physical therapy, what am I doing with my right arm in terms of what you do?
Traditionally, you would go into therapy, occupational or physical therapy or recreational therapy. And the idea would be that the movement is the medicine. You have to move in order to regain the ability to move that right arm, which is really counterintuitive. So you have to move the thing that is frustrating you, that doesn't work the way it used to. That's tough. So therapists are then put in this position of trying to motivate you to do a lot of repetitions with a high intensity. And those are sort of the things that they work with, the amount of movement or the dose of movement and the intensity of that dose.
And what typically might have you done before? Squeeze a rubber ball, mm-hmm. Work on a machine, that kind of a thing.
Yep. Just simple reaching exercises. Occupational therapists work with, they have people try to make grilled cheese sandwiches. They have people play poker or card games so that they're just using that hand as much as possible.
And so what would they be doing instead with what you prescribe?
Generally, I've designed it so that they can do exactly what they normally do. But the sensor, in the case of, say, blackjack, we actually did this and a woman was playing blackjack.
Uh-huh.
And was saying, this isn't therapy. And the occupational therapist kept saying, are you using your right arm that's been affected?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and is it hard? Yeah. Then it's therapy. So we had the sensor on, and at the end of her blackjack, she had to focus on the card. She had to sort of look at what she was doing. At
uh-huh.
the end, she did, we did this knowledge of results paradigm where she then looked at the screen and saw the abstract art that she had created. And her response was, you are kidding me. I did all that work. And really, it was just this sort of like this epiphany of, oh, it is work. It does count. So it could be something as simple as that.
Uh-huh.
And then that documentation is used in the medical records, right, to say, oh, actually, they did 20 minutes of activity.
And you can show it visually.
Yep. Yeah,
and so there's other ways of reading. To me, I might look at it and say it's an abstract form of art, but you look at it and you're seeing other kinds of measurements.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We're seeing speed of movement. We're seeing how much movement, dose. So in another example, there was a woman who had a gunshot wound to the brain and was really couldn't follow directions. I mean, it's the functional independence measure, cognitive measure. It was quite low. And so the therapist tried putting the sensor on their arm and having them just use, they call it theraputty.
Uh-huh.
It's like, you know, Play-Doh or silly putty. And people need it, like you need bread, right? Sort of manipulate it with their fingers, trying to get their fingers to move in coordination again.
Uh-huh.
And from having no ability to really communicate, this is the exercise we want done from the outside, this woman was able to, from the inside, start to move and see the picture being created and continue to move on her own because she wanted to make the picture. And she, again, did a full 40 minutes of therapy, and they actually let her go longer and brought lunch to her because she just wanted to watch what she was creating.
And the sensors, what do they look like?
We use a gyro or an accelerometer, gyroscope or an accelerometer, and it's as simple as an air mouse. I don't know if you've seen any of these air mouses that you can operate a computer screen with it, but you actually move it in the air. I'm moving my hand right now. I know you can't see this, but so instead of being placed on the desk, you just move it in the air. And it can be as small as sort of stamp sized to sort of like remote control size, television remote control sized.
You've been beta testing the software for this. It's going to get rolled out to be used by the public. How did that work? I mean, tell us about the relationship you have with this startup.
Yeah. So Rekovo licensed the software. While I am not paid by them, I consult in terms of sort of the creative design and the scientific theory.
They paid
behind.
For it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, they license it from the university. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they've been fantastic to work with. I really can't say enough about them. And then Interim Healthcare is this really forward-thinking home healthcare company that immediately grasped the implications of, oh, wow, we could get documentation and patient engagement like in one fell swoop. And we have an exclusive with them, or Rekovo has an exclusive with them for about 18 months. I've been really impressed with the Interim Healthcare leadership team. They care about their patients. They want it to be patient focused. They know that the work they're asking the patients to do is hard, and they're willing to do everything they can to help the participant actually do that.
I have a relative who's in home healthcare, and the documentation required is outrageous.
Yes, I agree.
So I can see why this is really exciting to them. That score
exactly.
alone.
I mean,
this is what we
it.
Did here. I don't have to write you a whole list of everything
exactly.
that you
exactly.
can see it for yourself.
I mean, you know, so we're saying, you know, insurance is saying, I'm going to send somebody into somebody else's home and just, I just sort of want some proof that of what they did, any proof. And what's an easy way to do that? Well, put an accelerometer or a gyroscope on somebody, the body part that has to move, and just record that it's moving. You know, you can do that with webcams. You can do that with the Kinect camera from Microsoft. There are all sorts of different ways to do it. I just chose a sort of lowest cost way to do it.
And this is also a motivating way to do it.
Right.
For the patient.
Right, right. Yeah, making it more personally meaningful. Nobody likes to be told what to do. I mean, I have two kids and a younger brother. And a father who's an Army veteran, and no one likes to be told what to do.
And it creates art and that they can take home, right?
Exactly, yeah. And so, you know, in addition to, I just don't want to be told what to do. Yeah, I've just had this injury and it's life-changing. And now you're just going to sit here and tell me what to do. You know what? No. I need to move. Just give me the basics. Give me the sort of seed exercise and let me take it from there. And then let me create something that I could, you know, post to Facebook to actually email to my loved ones that, you know, my father and mother live in Maine. You know, they actually email me things that they've done. So I can say, hey, fantastic. And it, you know, we have a little graph printout that says, oh, you know, for 20 minutes, you were 96% active. Wow. You know, you're only resting for a couple of minutes in that 20 minutes. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's important. Well, wow. This is so interesting. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
It's Lise Worthen Chowdhury. She's Associate Director of the Human Motion Analysis and Recovery Laboratory and a Research Assistant Professor of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at OSU's Wexner Medical Center. We've been talking about the program she designed, the software program that allows patients to create artwork while doing their physical therapy. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A lot of cheese is produced in the United States, nearly a billion pounds of it every month, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. makes it a staple in the American diet. A new book says it's making us addicted, with Americans eating 33 pounds of cheese per person every year. That's three times more than they did in 1970. In his latest book, Dr. Neil Barnard argues that too much cheese and dairy is linked to obesity, diabetes, and cancer. His book is entitled The Cheese Trap: How Breaking a Surprising Addiction Will Help You Lose Weight, Gain Energy, and Get Healthy. Dr. Barnard joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Great to be back with you.
So you argue that cheese is truly addictive in the same way as heroin, but on another kind of a scale. You call it dairy crack. What makes it so addicting in your opinion?
Well, you know, some foods are fattening, others are addicting, and I'm going to say that cheese is actually both. In fact, the numbers are frightening. The average American consumes 60,000 calories worth of cheese every single year. And I do think it's one of the big reasons why we have so much weight, so many weight problems in this country, and particularly in kids. But the addicting part, it was controversial until fairly recently, where I don't think it's really so controversial anymore. We have identified, and I don't mean just we, I mean many researchers now know, that there are opiates in cheese that do attach to the very same brain receptors that heroin or morphine attach to. They're not as potent, happily. They're not as mind-numbing as morphine is, but the most potent of these opiates that you'll find in cheese has about one-tenth the binding power to the brain receptors compared with pure morphine. So it's less, but we believe that it's just enough to make you want to come back to it, even if it's causing health problems and even if it's causing you to gain weight.
When did this addiction start? You're saying back in the 70s, but did it start with, Kraft mac and cheese type of thing?
Back, if you go back, it's an interesting thing. 1909 was when the USDA started tracking, and at that time, cheese was a European thing. In the U.S., the average person consumed less than 4 pounds of cheese in a year. But the big rise was first when fast food chains started coming in, particularly around the 70s. And then pizza chains, they were not ubiquitous the way they are now, but pizza has been both much more common and also piled higher. And if you were to go to Rome and go into any typical pizzeria, there's sort of a sprinkling of cheese on the pizza, not the inch and a half of asphalt that's on the pizzas here. And they also have pizzas that don't have any cheese at all. In every Roman pizzeria, they have them. But we, of course, don't recognize that. And here, pizza is a delivery vehicle for cheese, basically.
Yeah, I mean, they have four cheese pizzas.
There was actually a government contract. Many people don't realize that much of this is done with the government. By law, the USDA must promote American agricultural products. So we have found a number of the contracts they've had with fast food chains, and they did have a contract with Pizza Hut to release a pizza that had an entire pound of cheese on one serving of pizza. I'm talking about one person's pizza.
Well, forget the addiction part of all of this. We've known about the caloric content of cheeses for a long time.
We have. We have, and typical cheeses are 70% fat. Most of that fat is saturated fat, and every fat gram contributes 9 calories. And it can slide into your fat stores with very little conversion. And if you compare that to, say, bread or sugar, you could eventually gain weight by eating bread or eating sugar, but it's surprisingly hard for the body to do because the sugar first goes into glycogen. It's just stored in your liver, and it's not fat. It's just sort of spare batteries. And if you really overdo it, your body can make fat out of sugar, but doing that process burns up about a quarter of the calories that are in it.
Hmm.
So
not
it's much
so with
easier.
Cheese.
If you want to gain weight, cheese is a great way to do it.
Usually, Dr. Barnard, when I talk to you about anything, you say in moderation. You acknowledge that we have a cultural menu. I know you're vegan, and that's your ultimate goal, but you say it's okay in moderation. Do you say the same thing about cheese?
Well, you know, in theory, if you had a bit of cheese once a month, that's not going to increase your cardiovascular risk very much. But there are really two issues about it. The first is it's like having a cigarette every month. If something is sort of an addiction for you, you can't really control it that way, and nobody does. People have cheese every single day. So that little devil on your shoulder wakes up again every time you have it. And so the best way to ensure that you'll never lose weight is by having these foods that cause the problem in the first place. So moderation sounds great, but it's easier for people to just set up a fence and not be bothered with it anymore. The second issue is that when I wrote The Cheese Trap, a big chunk of it is on surprising health issues that come from cheese. And I'm speaking of things like asthma or joint pain. These are inflammatory conditions. And if a person's asthma is cured by not having cheese, they don't want to bring it back in moderation or anything, because it's like saying, I've got a peanut allergy, I can have one once every 6 weeks. Well, the answer is, like, just don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, there are good substitutes. You know, when I wrote this book, I worked with Drina Burton, who's a genius in the kitchen, and so we lay out, here's what I can have on my salad, here's how I can make a great sandwich, here's how I can make fettuccine alfredo and ravioli and even cheesecake without a drop of dairy cheese. So you can do it, and it's tastier, and you get the tremendous benefits of slimming down, feeling better, having a cholesterol level you're proud of, and your pain goes away, and you feel good.
You know, the more I think about it, it is funny. You know, even when you go to a fast food place, it says cheeseburger. It doesn't even say hamburger anymore. They just automatically, you have to ask for not to have cheese on it.
They do.
You have to really think about this, because it's in so many things now.
It is, and what that also means,
same with salads and that kind of a thing.
Absolutely, and it also means that we have come to accept all the health consequences of it because we didn't connect them. For example, cheese has hormones in it, and we have there's quite a lot of infertility around. Researchers in Rochester, New York, went into a fertility clinic, and they looked at men who ate the most cheese. They had lower sperm counts, they had worse fertility. And the connection was dairy cows are pregnant 9 months out of the year. They're milked pregnant. And the reason is that the farmer impregnates the cow every single year, and it takes 9 months for them to give birth, and so they're pregnant most of the time. They crank out estradiol, which is the main estrogen, and it gets into their milk. And the amounts are small. They're traces. So we had assumed it can't be too serious. But not only do we see these associations with low sperm counts, but also in women, there have been some associations with breast cancer risk that have, I don't think they're definitive at all, but they're enough that if you're thinking, do I want to give my 7-year-old daughter the cheese pizza or the vegan one? It's not a question anymore. Cheese products have too many health risks, in my view.
Are we talking about dairy products in general, or why do you focus on cheese?
Great question. Two reasons. The first thing is that whatever in milk is concentrated in the cheese. There's much more of those sensitizing proteins, much more of the opiate, the casomorphins that are the opiates. They're in milk, but they're concentrated in cheese. Same with the hormones. The hormones go along with the fat, and cheese is 70% fat. So if there are traces of hormones in milk, they're going to be concentrated in the cheese. The other reason is 10 years ago, I was doing a study for NIH on diabetes, and we used vegan diets. And they were fantastic. People did great. They lost weight and everything. But I kept hearing people say, the one food I really miss is cheese. It was not milk. It was not ice cream. Mm. It was specifically cheese. And so that's what set me on this path of trying to figure out, why is it we eat so much? Why is it fattening? Why does it cause these hormonal funny things that we're identifying? And more importantly, how can I work with some really good folks in the kitchen to give you a better sandwich and a better salad and a better dessert?
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Dr. Neil Barnard about his new book. It's entitled The Cheese Trap, How Breaking a Surprising Addiction Will Help You Lose Weight, Gain Energy, and Get Healthy. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Barnard about his book, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You raised the issue of lactose intolerance as well. It's a pretty common condition. I didn't know that. According to the National Digestive Diseases Information Clearinghouse, some 30 million to 50 million Americans are lactose intolerant. What does that mean, and what does it have to do with, cheese? Is it an issue with cheese as well?
It's really a question for dairy products in general, not so much cheese. But what it means, lactose intolerance was the word that meant you drink milk the lactose sugar that's in milk is, you can't digest it. And so that's somehow a disease, and you have to take a specially treated milk or take enzymes or something like that. That was the way medicine viewed this. Until the mid-1960s, and the research studies that were done were quite surprising, I have to say. Researchers in Baltimore went into a prison, and they happened to notice that lactose intolerance was rare among the white prisoners and common among the black prisoners. And they continued to do more and more research, and as time went on, people realized lactose intolerance is the norm, that all mammals and all humans have the enzymes to digest milk sugar until the age of weaning, when you're not going to be drinking your mother's milk anymore, and so you lose those enzymes. But a genetic mutation has caused that enzyme to persist in people of Northern European and some Middle Eastern background. And then with the African-American population, because of some mixing, lactose intolerance is about 70%, something like that. But they've now changed the terminology. That condition is normal. It is normal to not be able to digest cow's milk when you're an older child or adult. And they call this abnormal mutation that most white people carry, it's called lactase persistence, where you have these baby enzymes still in your body that allow you to have a bowl of ice cream without getting sick or without getting diarrhea. But nature is sometimes something you don't want to mess around with. If you're consuming dairy products beyond just the time when Mother Nature had the idea that you would, then there are a number of health issues that do result, including the ones we've talked about, but also ones that are more serious, such as prostate cancer, which is somewhat controversial, but two huge Harvard studies showed that the milk-drinking men have much higher risk of prostate cancer compared to others. So weaning was a good idea that nature had, and defeating it is not such a good idea.
The dairy industry, I've read, does not appreciate your take on this whole problem. They disagree with your conclusions. What have you heard from them?
Well, first of all, the dairy industry is not our enemy. They are good people who got into this business in the same way as every other agricultural product. You don't know the health risks for quite some time. The tobacco farmers in the 1700s, 1800s were good, decent people trying to earn a living. And just because the CDC says it'll kill you, it doesn't mean they were evil people. The same with the dairy industry. Having said that, there are certain things that we all agree on. Number one, dairy products are by far the biggest load of saturated fat in the diet. That is a contributor to heart disease and probably to Alzheimer's disease. Number two, cheese is loaded with salt. And to give you the numbers, 2 ounces of potato chips, which are salty, have 330 milligrams of sodium. 2 ounces of the typical processed cheese, the one in that yellow box, 800 milligrams of sodium. Very high in cholesterol, and there the hormones that I mentioned are there. We would agree these are traces, but we all agree that we should look at this. So the dairy industry is not stupid. They see the writing on the wall. Milk consumption has been falling for years, and they're doing a smart thing, which is they are diversifying. They are now buying up almond milk and soy milk, and I think they're right to do that, in the same way as the tobacco people started thinking, if this product goes down or if it's something we're not proud of anymore, let's have some other things we can sell. And the dairy industry is doing exactly that.
We have an email from Carl who says, what about feta cheese? My wife says that isn't so bad. Are there healthier cheeses?
Okay, great question. The reason people choose feta is not because it's healthier. They choose it because it's more romantic. It makes you think I must be on a Greek island. and because it has a more buttery mouthfeel. And so if you look at it, the percentage of the fat in feta, that is the saturated fat, that buttery one that raises your cholesterol, it's higher in feta than it is in the cow-based cheeses. So the goat type of cheeses in general have they have a higher percentage of saturated fat compared to the other.
Okay.
So on your spinach salad, instead of the feta, put little chunks of avocado. It'll give you the mouthfeel with very little saturated fat.
Facebook message from Rita. She says, I have restless leg syndrome, and since I eliminated dairy from my diet, I've reduced my symptoms, but I do miss cheese.
It will go away. I have to say, when I was in medical school, I ate cheese, I ate burgers, and I smoked cigarettes. I'm embarrassed to tell you. When I stopped these things completely, you find that that the cravings go away. And then you start looking at it, it's kind of crazy that people ever consume the milk of another species.
Brian in Clintonville, you're on the air with Dr. Neil Barnard. Hi, Brian.
How are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
I just had a question. I was a vegan for about 6 months. A couple minutes ago, you discussed some products using non-dairy alternatives, and I just found that making food at home, one of your examples was cheesecake. I made a cashew cheesecake one time, and I found it to cost me a whole lot more than if I just went out and bought cream cheese at the grocery store. And then just my other comment was I've had a hard time finding a non-dairy cheese that I like. There's a lot of companies out there, but they haven't really made my palate too happy yet.
I agree with that. So it's the cost and the taste. Dr. Barnard, what about the cost of non-dairy substitutes? It's not cheap.
Yeah, well, first of all, there's a new vegan cheese on the market, it seems like, every month. And it's because of the demand. There's enormous demand. There's so many of them. Think of them as cheese methadone. They're helping you get over your addiction, but it's not really the place to stay. Because I think what you've been hinting at is really correct, that the healthy foods are the simple ones, the vegetables and fruits and whole grains and beans and that kind of thing.
And quit trying to replace things like cheesecake with another kind of cheesecake.
We use that, you know, over the short term.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cheese Trap does have a bang-up, fantastic cheesecake recipe in it with
a
raspberry sauce, because I want people to see that you can make that shift. But as time goes on, what you discover is your tastes go towards simpler things. But right out of the box, you want sort of direct replacements. So we have a fettuccine alfredo in there that is, it's 100% dairy-free, but absolutely bang-up delicious.
And any ideas for kids?
Yes. Here's what I love.
Because I'm sure there's a mom or a dad out there going, yeah, right.
Well, first of all, let's keep in mind, we're not playing for small stakes here. Every three kids graduates from high school. He's going to be heavy as an adult. He's not going to be happy, and they'll be torturing themselves with diets that don't really work so hot. They are going to have health issues, heart disease. Their risk of Alzheimer's is high. These are not jokes. If food contributes to them, let's look at these foods and let's get them out of our life. But that's the finger-wagging part of me as a doctor. Let me have the more enticing part. I've got the kids over for birthday, and we're going to make a totally dairy-free pizza. And what we do is we've got the crust there, and this kid's got the green olives. The next one's got the black olives. The next one has the sun-dried tomatoes. And the next one has his little jar of nutritional yeast, which they sell at the health food store, and it tastes just like cheese. So they put on extra sauce, and every kid chooses their topping, and they stir a little of the nutritional yeast in the sauce. And 5 minutes later, nobody's even asking where the cheese is. So these are all little tricks that you can do, and your kids are going to be the healthiest ones on the block. Oh, and one last thing, just really quick. It's not just kids doing this. If you watch the Super Bowl, Tom Brady would tell you, he's the winningest quarterback in history. He doesn't consume dairy at all. Same with Aaron Rodgers, the Green Bay Packers. And when he said, I'm going dairy-free in Wisconsin, he did it because he says, I've got to extend my career. I cannot be inflamed all the time. And the best way to fight inflammation is to get away from those allergenic proteins. So kids can do it, but so can pro footballers and tennis players like Serena and Venus Williams and others too.
Just a quick email from Hannah. She says, my name is Hannah, and I am a cheese addict. I'm a student at Ohio State, and I can't express how relevant your guest's new book is to me because I genuinely believe I am addicted to cheese. So there you go. Dr. Neil Barnard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to talk with you again.
Dr. Neil Barnard, his new book is entitled The Cheese Trap, How Breaking a Surprising Addiction Will Help You Lose Weight, Gain Energy, and Get Healthy. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Well, Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. From muscle strains and twisted ankles to shin splints or a torn meniscus, injuries are painful and can set you back for weeks or months. When it comes to exercising, that is. Whether they are the result of bad luck or doing more than your body can handle, workout injuries can happen to anyone, no matter their experience or fitness level. And we're talking about ways to prevent workout injuries today and how to recover from them quickly. Joining me by phone is physical therapist at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center, Chris Kolba. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hey, thank you. Glad to be here.
And just to confuse everybody, we have another Chris with us. Joining me in the studio is owner and fitness instructor for Szabo Fitness, Chris Szabo. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here again.
Oh, Chris, I invited you on the show today because you're a fitness instructor. You injured your ankle. You had surgery on it. Tell us what happened, what the surgery was briefly.
Yes.
And without too much gory detail. And then, you know, the fact that you're back teaching.
Well, I had surgery on January 25th, and really what happened, it was an acute injury about 2 years ago. I was training for an obstacle course race. I fell off a beam, a high beam at the Autobahn, which I just came down on it real hard. Yep.
That.
Yes. And at the time, I knew it was pretty bad, and I just kind of was, I'm going to take note of that, and didn't really do anything for it. And then over the course of the last 2 years, it's just gotten a bit worse. And I thought, oh, you know, I'm just getting older. This is going to kind of ache for a while. And then last fall, it really grounded me and I couldn't run and it would swell. And so I went to OSU, actually, Chris, and I had it looked at. And I mean, it was a given. I mean, I had torn things and, you know, strained things. And so I had basically reconstruction of my ligaments and a lateral ligament reconstruction.
So, Chris, once again, she's a fitness instructor who's always telling her students, you know, listen to your body. Let me know if you have anything you need to adapt. Don't forget, you can do this or you can do this or you can do this. But you didn't even listen to your own advice.
Oh, no. That's not true now. That's not true. Well, I'm a big fan of listening to doctor's orders, for one. And I am a big fan. I'm kissing up to Chris here. But I'm a big fan of, you know, doing your physical therapy as well. I do think you need to listen to your body. And being that I've been in fitness for so long and I've been active for so long, I did listen to my body. But I think that people need to realize they're capable of doing more than they think when they're injured. And just because you get injured, let's say my ankle was injured, it doesn't mean I have to give up everything. I can do upper body everything. So I think the trick is to adapt your fitness, you know, regimen to what works for you.
And, you know, Chris Kolba, that's why I invited Chris Szabo on the show, because I'm so impressed by how she's kept up her teaching routine, adapting it, and then getting more and more. I can see her doing more and more every week. How do you work with people to get them back into working out? A lot of people just stop until they're over it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, so from the first day, I mean, I work with a little bit of a higher level of like an athletic population. So, yeah, on the first day, just making them aware that, hey, you know, even though you hurt your ankle, you still got another leg, two arms, and a core. So, you know, don't stop going to the gym, because all that, even if you can't use your right leg, for example, if you work your left leg, you're going to get a little bit of carryover, and there's no need to stop doing that. So I just, on day one, try to make them aware and encourage them to get in the gym and do this stuff. We'll get the leg tuned up to eventually, you know, join the party down the road. But, you know, that's the big thing, is just letting them know. And a lot of them are like, oh, I never really thought about it because I was injured. So I think awareness, you know, obviously creates choices. So that's the first step.
Chris Szabo, who did you consult with? I mean, how did you consult with somebody about what you could do as a fitness instructor?
I consulted with myself. I mean, I spoke with my, you know, my surgeon, and he knew what I did and what I wanted to do. And, you know, one of the first questions I asked him was, you know, when can I run? Which I knew it wasn't going to be like tomorrow, but just sort of to have a goal out there.
Yeah.
And he knew that I taught, and then I was just going to, you know, listen to my body. And I absolutely didn't want to take any shortcuts, because you want to get back on both feet as quickly as you can. But that's really ultimately what I did. So I agree with Chris. You know, you have a core, you have two arms, and you have a leg, and you might as well get everything stronger so you're ready to go and bounce back quicker.
Chris Kolba, what are the most common workout injuries you see?
Oh, geez. We could, you know, anything from just minor sprains and strains. Usually just general workout stuff is minor sprains and strains that, again, people will just kind of ignore for a little while, and then it just gets to the point where it either interrupts their ability to work out, or more importantly, it starts to interrupt their sleep. Now they seek out, you know, the health professional to kind of get some help with that. So,
and there's wear and tear and there's strain, and then there's like an injury that, like the one that Chris described, and that's really the only time I've ever been put off is when I actually fell one time ice skating for the love of God, but I ended up having a frozen shoulder a year later. But I did. I kept putting it off and putting it off and putting it off, dealing with it. And is it something you think? I mean, Chris, you know, notwithstanding, I mean, when you do have an injury, how do you know when to go in and see somebody to find out if it's bad? How do you know when not to try to push through it?
Yeah, my general rule is, you know, again, listen to your body, like Chris mentioned, you know, try to work around it for a week or two, you know, and if your pain's, you know, on the 0 to 10 scale, if it's under a 4, try to work around it. But if it's not getting better after at least 2 to 3 weeks, you know, go in and get it checked out, because most of the time, a couple weeks of therapy, we can get you squared away rather than like you did, let it go, and then you end up with a frozen shoulder, and now we have multiple complications, and or it becomes a chronic issue, and maybe, you know, we can't get it better, and you end up having to have surgery. So, you know, I think it's kind of common sense, you know, try to nurse it for a couple weeks and see if you can kind of work around it. But if not, you know, get in and get it taken care of, a few visits, and then boom, you're on your way.
So, Chris, you have a walking, whatever you call it, one of those boots.
I do. It's lovely.
It is. It's absolutely adorable. So what was your approach to staying in the swim?
Well, so I had to be non-weight bearing for, I guess he said, about 4 to 6 weeks. And so I was on crutches, and I was really good about that. So that wasn't actually too bad, because I'm pretty strong upper body-wise. But, you know, it's challenging if you want to have a cup of coffee, whatnot. So I really listened to that, and then I just tried to figure out what could you do or what can I do. And I would say the same thing to a client. What can we do around that injury? And then when I was able to, actually last Friday, I progressed and got off crutches, or wean off crutches, which was like quickly, and into the boot. And so you just take step by step. And during the process, it's good, because while I'm teaching, it's nice to also be a kind of a representative to others to say, hey, look what you can do when you're injured. I mean, this is something you can work around. So
yeah, it's not like something you see all the time, which is why I suggested it, Chris Cole, but as a topic of discussion, what kind of advice, say, let's someone's one of their, you know, they're wearing a boot, one of their legs, one of their feet is out of commission. How do you approach a workout regimen, Chris Kolba?
Well, from a workout regimen, like I mentioned, you just go into the gym and work all your other stuff. But there is quite a few things we can do early on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can educate the patient a little bit on that to, you know, do some of that at home. But, you know, making sure that, one, they restore their normal joint motion, because that's going to significantly restrict things down the road, making sure we get the muscles turned on. And more important, the balance of the proprioceptive system, because that's usually where most people kind of miss out on. And that's what's going to significantly increase your risk of injury down the road.
What is that blah blah system?
The balance, the proprioception, okay. Just your balance system, just kind of getting your brain muscle connected. Because again, even though it's your ankle, your knee, your hip, your core, everything's going to really be thrown off. And if you don't kind of retune that up and kind of get out of a traditional straight ahead type of workout program and get some side to side movement, some rotational movement, some rotation control, and like a lot of balancing, again, it's just going to increase your odds of being successful down the road, or increase your risk of re-injuring, even though you're kind of walking around normal and feeling pretty good.
Can diet make a difference?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I always tell people, I don't harp on it about it because it's really not my area, but mm-hmm. I tell them it's like a computer, garbage in and garbage out. I mean, your body's trying to heal, so it needs nutrients, it needs nutrition to help with that. So, you know, if you can stay hydrated, if you can, you know, eat well, I believe it's going to make a significant impact on your, you know, your overall outcome.
I would also add in their sleep, I think, is a really big deal. I mean, I noticed I was a lot more tired, and I was just, what's going on, you know? And it's just, I had to kind of remind myself what was happening.
Your body's repairing itself.
Trying to repair, yeah. So.
And as far as the core, that's a big thing. A lot of people don't think about that. It's very big in your instruction,
yeah,
though,
huge.
Chris. And it helps with recovery, too, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, core is in every part of when I teach or when I work with somebody one-on-one. And when you've been in class or when somebody is in class, you can see even with my situation that core, you know, we're always going to do core stuff. And so I think, you know, I think Chris would agree with me. You keep that strong, then the balance and all that's going to come back a lot quicker than if you disregard that as a group that you need to work on.
You know, when I watch Chris instructing Chris Kolba, I'm worried, oh my God, what if she falls while she's showing us this thing that we're supposed to do? And it scares me. I mean, is that the risk of re-injury that you were talking about, or it's a little nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I would agree, but I would worry less about Chris because she's fit, she's active, she's strong. But your average person that isn't, they might take a tumble a little quicker, a little sooner. So yeah. I wouldn't worry too much about her. She can handle herself, I believe.
It's a stop-drop roll maneuver if needed. But, yeah, so, you know, it really does come down to everybody's different and, you know, everybody has different limits. But I think it's real important that people realize they can do more than they think when they get so-called laid up.
Yeah, right. They can do more than they think. And you're saying, you know, head to the gym, Chris Kolba, and do what you normally would do. And a lot of people how much of the recovery is due to people being already physically fit and that you repair better if you're in better shape?
Oh, that you see that in athletes, even though they have a lot of things available to them that the average public doesn't. But they definitely heal faster and they do better. They have a different mindset, you know, on how to approach that. And so we try to get, you know, our average person to realize that, you know, think of rehab as your new sport now or your new activity, and attack it the same way with the same mentality you would with, you know, whether you like playing with your kids in the backyard or playing a particular sport. Come into rehab with that mindset and attack it the same way, you're going to have a much better outcome.
People who do play sports, that's always a tough thing when we work on spontaneous movement where you're responding to something. Is that something you work on?
Yeah, that's part of what we work on. Like, you know, in my facility here, like I said, we see a little bit more of an active population.
Right.
And I have a pretty extensive strength and conditioning background. So we pull all that into our rehab because, again, we're dealing with people that are used to being active. So, again, getting them back in the gym, getting them on working on their conditioning while they're injured is huge. And then progressing them to the point where, you know, they can plant their foot into the ground, decelerate their body weight, and make a direction change so they can safely return to their sport is definitely where we want to take them if we can see them long enough based on today's insurance model.
Yeah, right. That's right. You probably spend quite a bit of time just trying to make sure people get all the facts straight before you have to let them go.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the best we can. We got to try to prepare them to be able to go back to what it is they want to do and make sure they're safe and they feel comfortable that they can do that. And many people can.
Yeah. Chris, that spontaneity thing, you work on that a lot.
I do. I mean, we do a lot of reaction drills, that sort of thing, and changing up different planes of movement a lot during class. I mean, I think that as everybody ages, that's something that is easy to take for granted or forget to practice. And so I like to put that as well as balance and coordination, you know, all those things into a class.
And, you know, just going back to the original injury occurred when you were training for an obstacle course. I've done some of those, and they are a lot of fun, but they do pose a lot of different challenges.
Yeah, you sign your life away for sure. And, you know, that's how it happens, right? It's, you know, you can be active for a long time, and it just takes this one, bam, you know, ice skating, and there you go. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, that's an inherent risk in whatever, you know, if you're going to be an active person, you sort of have this inherent risk that you're taking on. And I don't know, I feel very lucky that, you know, this is the first time I've had to be laid up, so to speak, you know, in my life. So I have a real deep respect for people that come back and back again and again from injury.
And I would imagine, I mean, we only have a minute left, Chris Kolba, but just staying working out, for me, it's more mental health than anything else anymore. It just attitudinally, it emotionally changes people when they stay in shape.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like I tell people, like Chris mentioned, you know, three things we learn or we lose as we get older is balance, strength, and rotational movement. They're all trainable. So continue to train, keep yourself and your mind active and healthy, and then your golden years can be golden instead of brown and crusty.
Chris Kolba, physical therapist at OSU's Wexner Medical Center. Thanks to you.
Hey, great talking to you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Chris Sable, owner of and fitness instructor at Sable Fitness. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great to be here again.
That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.